Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist, here with you today to talk a little bit about DNA and the science of inheritance, how we acquire the traits that we possess. Now, I know that most of my previous few podcasts have been about the topic of sex and sexuality, and I'm sure that many of my listeners are looking forward to my return to the topic, specifically the topic of homosexuality. And I anticipate that the next logical question in that series would be whether homosexuality has a genetic or cultural basis. So I can't really address that unless I talk about genetics first. As a matter of fact, I'm going to need to talk about genetics if I want to talk about race as well, and eventually I do want to get around to that. So today is going to be a sort of basic primer, or primer, some people like to say, in the science of genetics. And I have covered a little bit of this previously in the podcasts that talked about the development of sex characteristics. So to recap, all human beings possess 46 chromosomes. Chromosomes are the stuff of life. They are what makes life possible. In your chromosomes lies the code, the blueprint for the building of your body. Literally is a blueprint with instructions for building your body. And as I've mentioned in those previous podcasts, DNA not only provides the instructions, it does the actual labor. It literally builds or assembles, synthesizes the proteins that make up your body. So chromosomes occur in pairs, and you get one member of each pair from your male parent and the other member from the female parent. And they go together, sort of like a pair of shoes. They match, but they're not exactly the same. We call that homologous. These are homologous chromosomes, meaning almost the same. They are the same in that they look the same. They carry genes for the same traits, which are always in the exact same spot on the exact same chromosome. But the variation of the gene that they carry may be different. So to be specific, you can talk about something like blood type. Scientists actually know exactly where the gene for blood type is located. It's on chromosome number 9. Number 9 for you Beatles fans. If you recall, we have these 23 chromosome pairs. And they're numbered, 1 through 23. Actually, really, 1 through 22, because the 23rd pair, those are your sex chromosomes, and if you have two Xs, you are female. If you have an X and a Y, you are male, unless, of course, you fall into another category, which we discussed in those previous podcasts. The entire human genome was mapped out in the Human Genome Project, which was completed ahead of schedule in the year 2003. And since that time, scientists have known the location of every protein that is produced by your DNA. They're busily sequencing the genome of other animals right now, and of prehistoric ancestral human populations like the Neanderthals. It's really fascinating stuff. So what the Human Genome Project did is it decoded DNA. It looked at the composition of our genetic structure and determined which sections are responsible for producing which proteins. That is just the beginning of the science. It is by no means the answer. It is really just the first question. The first question was, what does our DNA do? And the answer is, it codes for proteins, and here's what they are and where they live. The next question is, well, what do those proteins do? What processes in the body do they contribute to? That is a much larger question, so we really are only just beginning here. So the same protein gets coded by the same region on the same gene, numbered 1 through 23, in every human being. They are consistent. These places are called loci. That's L-O-C-I. It's the plural of locus, not the Norse god. So to return to blood type, you would inherit the gene for specifically your type of blood, whether it's type A, type B, type AB, or type O, that gene is located on chromosome number 9, and it comes in three forms. You can inherit a form that codes for the production of type A, Or you could inherit a form that codes for the production of type B, or you could inherit the form that codes for the production of type O blood, ABO. It's called the ABO blood group. And those three variants or possibilities are called alleles. That's A-L-L-E-L-E-S. Alleles are variations of a gene. They're the possible forms that any one particular gene can take, any one particular trait, like blood type. Now, in the case of blood type, you actually have an interesting situation of what's called codominance. And that's what I'm really out to explain today. It's about dominant and recessive traits. I think this is the number one thing that even people who have studied DNA in school still misunderstand, and I think it's mistaught often. What it means for an allele to be dominant is that no matter what, it's going to get expressed. You're going to see it. And what it means for an allele to be recessive is that it's kind of quiet, and you're probably not going to know it's there. You're probably not going to see it. The only way that you would see it or hear it would be if there were two of them, because together they would gang up and be loud enough to be heard. So the general rule is that if an allele is recessive, you would have to inherit it both from your mother and your father. You'd have to have two copies of it in order for it to actually be expressed, in order for you to actually possess the trait. So the ABO blood group actually has two dominant alleles and one recessive allele. Both A and B are dominant, which means that if you inherit that allele, you will have type A or type B blood, whereas the O allele is recessive. The only way that you would have type O blood would be if you had two copies, if you inherited it from both of your parents. So on chromosome number 9, mom's side, the one that came from mom, let's say you inherit an allele that codes for the production of type A blood. And then on dad's side, in the same position, on the same chromosome, number 9, you inherit an allele that codes for the production of also type A blood. Well, in that case, it's, you know, without doubt or question, you would have type A blood, and you would be homozygous for that. Homozygous, homo. Same, zygous comes from zygote, the fertilized egg. Really, it just means that you have two copies of the same exact allele, homozygous. Homozygous A, type A blood. If you got a type B allele from your mom and a type B allele from your dad, then you would be homozygous B, type B blood. If you got type O from mom and type O from dad, then you would be, guess what? Homozygous O, type O blood. So those are the clear-cut cases. Well, what happens if you inherit type A blood from mom and type B blood from dad? Well, for one thing, you would not be homozygous. You would be heterozygous. If homo means same, hetero means different. So that's heterozygous blood type. Seeing as they're both dominant and they both get expressed, then you would have type AB. And your blood would be fairly equally composed of types A and B blood. Quite literally, your blood would have cells, some that were A and some that were B. Now, what happens if you get type A from mom and type O from dad? Well, that O is recessive and it won't get expressed. You will not see it unless there are two of it. It's because the type A is dominant. It's aggressive. It screams really loud and almost completely shuts up the type O that's standing there right next to it. And so you wind up with entirely type A blood. Same thing happens if you get type B from one parent and type O from the other. B just tromps down, steps all over type O, and you wind up with your type B blood. And the only way, once again, you get type O is to have two copies. You inherit it from both parents. Now, since type O blood is recessive, it's homozygous recessive, it only happens when you have two recessive alleles, people with type O blood are referred to as universal donors, because you can give type O blood to anybody, A, B, or O, and it's not going to be a problem. Type A can receive it because it won't have an impact over the expression of that type A blood. Type B can receive it for the same reasons, and type O, well, just fits right in. So type O is the universal donor. If you have type O blood, please consider donating it because anybody can receive it to a large extent. This, of course, ignores factors like Rh, whether your blood is positive or negative, which is controlled by different genes entirely. So if type O is the universal donor, then AB is the universal recipient. Someone with type AB blood can receive blood from anybody, and it won't cause a problem at all. It'll just fit right in. But that's what you call a codominant system, because there are two dominant alleles. Simple traits are controlled by just this one gene. In other words, the trait for blood type, whether you're A, AB, B, or O, that's controlled by just this one gene sitting on chromosome number 9. And that's what you call a Mendelian trait. A Mendelian trait is a trait controlled by only one gene, so it's a pretty simple thing to understand. Either you have it or you don't. There's usually only a couple of possibilities. Now, there are a lot of misconceptions over this idea of dominant and recessive. So I'm going to tell you a story just to kind of convey to you how confused people really are about it. This is one of those moments where some listeners might actually be able to identify me from this story. I think it marks me out. So just shh, okay? So I tell my students this story about when I was in seventh grade, the first time I encountered the study of genetics and DNA. I had this teacher who taught something that I think a lot of teachers teach incorrectly. And he talked about eye color. And here's what he said. He said, brown eyes are dominant and blue eyes are recessive. Now, what that means is that your brown-eyed parents, they can be hiding a blue-eyed trait. It can be in there. Remember how I said if you inherited two A's, you'd be type A, and that's homozygous? Well, if you inherited an A and a B, you'd have heterozygous blood. Heterozygous is when the alleles are different. So what happens if your mom, say, is heterozygous brown? She's got brown eyes, but she has a blue allele in there somewhere. And I'm not saying this is true or correct. I'm just using it as an example. So we'll say mom has heterozygous brown. She's got a blue allele and a brown allele, and only the brown allele gets expressed. So she could conceivably marry a husband who has the same condition. He's got brown eyes, but he's got a blue allele that's not expressed, and they together could have a blue-eyed child because that blue-eyed child would inherit the blue allele from both parents. So brown-eyed parents can have a blue-eyed child. But in the other situation where you have blue-eyed parents, since blue eyes are recessive, they don't have any brown-eyed allele hiding anywhere. If they did, it would be expressed, and their eyes would be brown. But they're not. They're blue, which would indicate that they have only blue alleles. All right? So blue-eyed parents cannot have a brown-eyed child. And then he said, looking around the classroom at a group of 12 and 13-year-olds, so if your eyes are brown and both of your parents have blue eyes, you ought to check the mailman's eyes. Oh, I know he was joking, but I swear to you, at least one child in the class got really upset. I remember tears. I really do. And, that was just so tragic and wrong. It was tragic and wrong because it was a sad thing to do to a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old. And it was just wrong. Scientifically, it's absolutely not the case. It's completely incorrect. It's absolutely, positively, 100% possible and normal for two blue-eyed parents to have a brown-eyed child. Happens all the time. And he did not understand that. And then the thing is, when I got to college, they had the same example in the textbook. Of course, there wasn't any recommendation that you should check the mailman's eyes or anything like that, but there was the same idea, the same notion that you see in all kinds of things. Even college textbooks that say that brown eyes are dominant and blue eyes are recessive, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. It does not work that way. It is not that simple. Because the trait for eye color is not a Mendelian trait. It is not controlled by one gene that occurs in however many forms. It doesn't work that way. It is a polygenic trait. That means that more than one gene contributes to its expression. So the color of your eyes, there's so many factors that go into that. So the first thing to know is that the substance that produces pigment in your body, whether it's in your skin, your eyes, or your hair, it's always the same predominantly. It's called melanin. And melanin is produced by specialized cells called melanocytes. And then it's distributed throughout the skin, throughout the hair, throughout the body. What that means is that there's at least three genes at work there. I mean, not specifically, but just think about it hypothetically. There is a gene that has something to do with forming your melanocytes and making sure that they operate correctly. There's at least one gene involved in that, probably more than one. And then there's at least one gene involved in coding for the production of melanin, actually creating, synthesizing that protein. And then there are genes that are responsible probably for the distribution of melanin. And then on top of it all, there's the question of activation because melanin has to be activated in order to be visible. And an example of temporary melanin activation, well, we call that tanning. Some people have the ability to tan. I do not. My people lost that a long time ago. But if you're one of the lucky light-skinned people who whose skin darkens when exposed to the sun, then that's terrific. You have a little built-in sunscreen, and you're able to experience the temporary activation of melanin. So it does fade, but then there is melanin that is always activated that gives you your base skin color. And so there's this question of how much melanin is activated. There's how much melanin is produced. How much do you actually possess? How much is activated? So there's at least four genes, probably a lot more than that, at work here. So when it comes to the question of blue-eyed parents having a brown-eyed child, it is entirely possible because, hypothetically speaking, mom could have blue eyes because, well, she possesses a lot of melanin, but not very much of it is activated. And dad could have blue eyes because, well, he doesn't have very much melanin, but all of it is activated. This is very extremely oversimplified. But it would then follow that Junior would inherit a lot of melanin from one parent and a lot of activation from the other, and hence have darker eyes than both of them. Brown eyes. It's perfectly logical. Even though scientists have decoded the human genome, they actually can't point to the regions that tell you what color someone is, what their skin color is. There is no set of genes that are located throughout the genome that we can point to and say, oh yes, this reads like that, and this one reads like that, and so this person is brown, or I don't even know what shade of brown or white or pink or whatever. It just doesn't exist. Skin color is a polygenic trait, and it's just probably the best example of polygenic traits, but so is eye color, so is hair color. These are all polygenic traits. There's more than one gene at work here. So it's not cut and dried. Now, when you're lucky enough to be looking at a trait that is monogenic, which I don't think anybody really uses that word, we just call them Mendelian traits, traits controlled by one gene, then they're very, very simple to understand. They have a limited range of expression. They can only be a certain number of things, right? There's one gene for the expression of blood type sitting on chromosome number 9, and there are only three possibilities. There are only three alleles. It's either going to hold an A, a B, or an O, right? And then you take that gene and you look at the possibilities. Well, how does it work out? So there's three possibilities on mom's chromosome and three possibilities in dad's chromosome. 3 to the 3rd is 9. There are 9 possibilities, right? Go through them. AA, AB, AO, BB, BA, BO, OA, OB, OO. Okay, so that's 9 possibilities, and of course some of them are doubles. OB is the same as BO, but you get it. 9 possibilities in terms of the ways that the alleles can combine, and that's it. And these 9 possibilities, because of the interaction of dominance and codominance, they result in only 4 possibilities, A, B, AB, and O. That's blessedly simple. That's incredibly lovely. If only all genes worked that way, we would have understood ourselves a very, very long time ago. But most things are controlled by the interaction of multiple genes, and let's not forget the factors of experience and nutrition and all the cultural things that kick in and have an influence on the expression of your genes as well. Let me simplify this even further and tell you a little bit about the Mendelian experiments with the pea plants. He was very lucky, Mr. Mendel. He really was. He picked a very simple plant, and it turned out that the pea plant is so many of the traits that Mendel investigated were these Mendelian traits named after him, lucky man. Not that he lived to see it or anything, but so many of the traits he investigated were controlled by only one gene. So, example, the height of the plant, it was either tall or it was short. There was nothing in between. There were no intermediaries. There was no gray area. The plant was either tall or it was short, and the tall gene turned out to be dominant. The short gene turned out to be recessive, and the way he found that out is because while tall plants sometimes managed to produce short offspring, which meant they were hiding a short allele somewhere, short plants always produced true. They always produced short offspring, never produced a tall offspring. So they were pure, they were homozygous recessive. So with a trait like that, where you've only got 2 alleles and one's dominant and one's recessive, there's only 2 possibilities. You're either going to be tall or you're going to be short. That's it. A lot of the traits Mendel investigated, like the color of the seed pods, green or yellow, nothing in between, green or yellow, one or the other, on or off. And this is the way most Mendelian traits work. You either have it or you don't, or you have one of the versions. It's very straightforward. But polygenic traits are a lot more complicated because you've got the interaction of so many different genes in some cases that instead of getting an on-off switch where you either have the trade or you don't, or maybe a selector where you've got four to choose from, you have a whole range of variation from one extreme to the other, what we think of as a continuum. As a matter of fact, it's called continuous variation, a whole range of variation from one extreme to the other. And continuous variation is exactly what explains skin color. It is the interaction of many genes at work, and they render, well, every shade, all the way from albinism, albino people, where there's zero pigment, to the darkest, darkest people you can imagine, and everything in between. It's a continuum. And the truth is, there's no one place that you can point to on that scale and say, that's it, that's the dividing line. Everybody on this side is white and everybody on the other side is black. No matter what you do, that's a cultural decision and it's not based in biology. And again, honestly, we don't know where those genes are. We may know what all the proteins are, but we don't know how they all work. And we have not yet figured out how to look at someone's genome and say, oh yeah, that's the color of their skin. I mean, we may even be able to say that person's really dark, but are they dark as in ancestors from Africa, or dark as in ancestors from southern India, or dark as in Aboriginal Australian ancestors? These are questions we have yet to answer. So this is a really important concept, this concept of continuous variation. I know it sounds really tweaky and geeky, but it's crucial. And it really speaks to the overall theme of the podcast, just in general. I know that a lot of you can feel it, that I like to talk about binary oppositions and the gray areas in between. And that's exactly what this is about today. Genetics is the same thing. With a Mendelian trait, you've got a binary opposition. You can think of it that way, simplify it that way. It's one or the other. You have it or you don't. It's on or it's off. It's like a light switch. But with a polygenic trait, you've got a continuum. It's more like a dimmer. It runs all the way from one extreme to the other, being off to being fully on and somewhere in between. And things that run on a continuum are difficult for us humans, aren't they? Things like the expression of sex, or sexuality, remember the Kinsey scale, or skin color. Well, we have a hard time with this stuff because we like to be binary. We like to be black and white, so to speak. But most things run on a continuum. And if I've got one really explicit goal in this podcast, is to shatter those binaries. It's to take them apart and help my listeners to see that the world's a lot more complicated than we want it to be. Because if we can accept its complexity, we'll be better able to deal with it. So the truth about these so-called dominant and recessive traits is that the whole matter is complicated immensely by the question of whether a trait is determined by only one gene or by the interaction of multiple genes. So when you try to talk about something like eye color and you want to simplify it and say, well, brown eyes are dominant and blue eyes are recessive, that's just ridiculous because it's a polygenic trait. It's controlled through the interaction of multiple genes. And that means that it results in a continuum and a range of expression all the way from one end to the other. It's true of skin color. Same thing, continuous variation. And I believe to some extent, if there is a genetic component in sexuality, then it will be true of sexuality as well, as reflected in the Kinsey scale from 0 to 6, where 0 is 100% heterosexual and 6 is 100% homosexual, and there's a whole range of variation in between. These last two subjects are definitely fodder for further podcasts. I'm sure that I will be returning to them in the future. But for today, I just want to sum that up for you. I just want you all to understand that when you talk about things like a gene for intelligence or a gene for homosexuality or a gene for a particular type of mental illness, you're very, very lucky, and it's very, very unusual to find a single gene for anything, to find a Mendelian relationship where there's one gene that controls that trait. It's far more often the case that whatever you're trying to identify is a polygenic trait. It's something that's controlled through the interaction of very many genes, which we have yet to identify. So it's really completely incorrect to talk about these genes, a gene for intelligence, a gene for sexuality, or even a gene for skin color. There may be a gene for melanin production, but there's no one gene for skin color. I know it would be great if everything were simple, but it's not. I'm going to tell you one more story that is the kind of thing that makes me really identifiable, but I don't know how else to do this, but, you know, just to share myself with you. It goes back to that topic of race, and I want you to hear, every time I use that word race, I want you to hear the air quotes that I put around it, okay? Because I've already taken that first step toward deconstructing it right here in this podcast, right? Explaining it as a continuum. There's much more to talk about, but let me just tell you this little anecdote here. Anecdotes aren't science, they're just fun, okay? That's how I look at them. So when I was growing up, I made a friend who was African American. And one day my mother asked me if I would like to meet my friend's mother, because they were all getting together that evening to play cards, and I said, sure, why not? I was probably about 9 or 10 years old. And so that evening, I was invited downstairs to the finished basement where they would gather, and I walked in the room, and I saw a bunch of white ladies sitting around a card table. And I said to myself, well, that doesn't seem right, because my friend is black. But, you know, I had some common sense, and so I didn't say anything. I just said hello and introduced myself. And the following day, I brought it up to my mom, and I said, hey, you know, so-and-so's mom is white. And my mom said, yeah. I said, but my friend is black. And my mom said, yeah. And so I said, well, was she adopted? And my mother said, no. I said, well, is her father black? No. Well, then, what happened? How did that work? And she told me a story. And again, I was about 9 or 10 when this happened. So to be honest with you, many years later, when I started teaching, I actually called her and I asked her if my recollection of the story was true. And absolutely, indeed, she confirmed it so many decades later. So here's what she told me then. And again, so many years later, two white people from New York City, two white Jewish people, I believe, from New York City had met and fallen in love and married and had a child who was born looking for all the world like an African-American person would look. Dark skin and dark hair, dark eyes, just everything. And I always think, oh my gosh, imagine the father's reaction, right? I mean, immediately he must have thought his wife had cheated on him. How horrible, right? I don't know how they weathered that. I don't know how that couple survived that. But it turned out that both of them had African-American ancestors in their recent past. And I think in one case, one of them knew about it. And in the other case, they didn't know. And I believe the story goes that, you know, these were folks who were of mixed heritage, mixed quote-unquote race, who passed through life as white folks because they were very light-skinned. But nonetheless, they carried with them certain genes, I suppose. So the likelihood of this happening is so infinitesimally small that it makes the story seem like just a story, like an urban myth. But I assure you that this happened. And unfortunately, my mom is no longer around to corroborate. But she and I believe it. And you know what? I think there is an example out there on the web somewhere, one famous example of something like this, where a very dark-skinned person was born to two very light-skinned parents. And again, the odds are just crazy small, but it happened. There was recent African ancestry on both sides of the family, and somehow those genes met up. And so I say to my students, look at this woman, look at this young woman that I knew. Look at this quote-unquote black woman born to two quote-unquote white people. I mean, she is the biological child of these two white people, and yet, for all intents and purposes, she functions in the world as a black woman. How must that be? I mean, whoa, I wish that I could meet her and have this conversation. That would be amazing. But beyond that, you know, you have to ask that question, well, what is she, right? People, what is she? What a stupid question. What is she? Is she black or is she white? Well, the answer to that question, what is she, is that she's a human being and that it's a stupid question. I mean, how can a child be born to a race different than that of his or her parents? That's just ridiculous. Skin color has nothing to do with quote-unquote race. It's just crazy talk. It really is. So that topic of race, of course, you know, I will cover in greater depth, and I will do a podcast on skin color and the evolution of skin color as well. And I will shortly return to tie up some more loose ends on the topic of sexuality. I'm thinking that what I might want to do next, though, is to plumb through some of the letters I've received and, yeah, a couple of phone calls. Thank you so much. Thank you, Frank, for your patience and persistence. It's really greatly appreciated. I am going to listen to some of those messages and look back and read some of the emails and see if I can't spend a podcast replying to some of you who have been so kind to correspond with me. I really appreciate it. I am so deeply enjoying watching the listenership to the show grow. It's really quite amazing. I expected that it would fall off a bit when I took that break over the holidays, but actually it grew, and that's amazing. And without any promotion at all, it's all just word of mouth. So thank you. Thank you very much for talking about the podcast and telling your friends about it. It's really great. I am doing this purely for my own sanity, as I explained, I think, in the first podcast. It's not being monetized in any way. I'm not looking to make a buck on it. It's not about that at all. I don't plan on selling any merchandise. I plan on giving it away, if anything. The reward for me is in you. It's in the listeners. It's in the correspondence and the interaction. That's the reward. So thank you very, very much for that. And hello to all my listeners near and far, my loyal listeners in the United States and Canada, and my very loyal listeners again in Australia and Ireland, and all those folks out there and all those places that just continue to shock me. Thank you so very much, and please do spread the word. I invite you to write to me at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. That's theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. Or you can call and leave me a voicemail at 206-312-3526. That's 206-312-3526. Leave me a message and leave me a show suggestion, a question. I'd love to play it on the air to get us started. Check out the blog at theanonymousanthropologist.com. That's theanonymousanthropologist.com. And I've still got the Facebook page, although I don't really have very much access to it. I can masquerade there as something called TAA Helper. I know it's silly. I made it up in desperation one day. So if you see a post from TAA Helper, that's indeed me. I am helping myself, the anonymous anthropologist. But I don't really have administrative control over the page anymore, so please forgive me for not being more active over there. However, I do see it when you like me, and I have seen a couple comments that were made, which I'll hopefully respond to in the next podcast. And thank you all for listening. I look forward to speaking with you again soon. Till next time, take care.
Am I recording?